The Real Hillary Clinton, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Some Democrats are finding it hard to get excited about Hillary Clinton, the candidate, but this reporter saw a different Hillary Clinton in action as Secretary of State.
There's something that seemed to happen to her when she would get out of U.S. airspace, and then suddenly she would relax and be herself.
Plus, a former CIA operative battles his demons.
If you ever can get used to having six different names and answering your phone in five different languages and, you know, lying to everybody who loves you most, then, brother, you're a stronger man than me.
And a British airport spends millions to train dogs to sniff out illegal drugs and bushmeat, but instead the dogs are only interested in
cheese and sausages.
Bad dogs. The story's coming up here on The World. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. We've got a great mix for you from around the globe today. A Greek Orthodox priest on the island of Lesbos tells us what he hopes will come out of this weekend's visit by the Pope, who will bear witness to the refugee crisis there, and China's plans to become the world soccer powerhouse by mid-century. But let's start with a spy story. This is not one of the many spy stories that have been written by any number of CIA desk agents. This spy story was written by a former field operative. Douglas Laux is the son of a steelworker. Douglas was going to college in Indiana when he applied to the CIA. A few years later, the 20-something was dropped into the back of Beyond on the Afghan-Pakistan border.
I had everything packed, ready to go, and the second I touched down, realized I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
That was back in 2010. Laux saw that mission through and stayed in the CIA for three more years. Now he's written a new memoir called Left of Boom, How a Young CIA Case Officer Penetrated the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which brings us back to that moment Laux just described when he first touched down in Afghanistan. He says his first surprise was realizing the agency had taught him the wrong dialect of Pashto.
I was trained in Pashto. I walked out the door with a 3-3. On the government scale, which is to say you're fluent in reading and writing the language. But once I got there, I realized, hey, the word that I use for car is not the word they use for car. So it was a trial by fire.
I mean, here's another example of the agency's lack of awareness. The military would broadcast on Pashto language radio the names of Taliban fighters. They were hunting and offering money for information, and you ended up paying for bogus information. How did that work out?
I know a listener might hear that and go, oh, my God, you know, but I'm not trying to give a black eye to the agency. I'm not trying to poke him in the eye. What that is, again, was a learning experience. And so everyone in the community, they were coming to me saying, hey, we know about these guys. Yeah. And then it was a few months in, sitting with my terp, and we're listening to the radio going, oh,
your terp.
Everyone has access. Yeah, my interpreter. Yeah. So
everyone's got
anyway,
access.
Anyway, tragicomic. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at one point you get to know a warlord who helps you by calling in the location of an Al-Qaeda operative. That operative is then killed in a drone strike. I mean, as someone who works for an intelligence gathering agency, wouldn't it have made more sense to capture and interrogate the suspect? And how do you feel when that happens?
Not terribly good. Now, I will point out for your listeners, you said drone strike. I did not say that. I don't write that in the book. Mm. That's you reading between the lines. If you think it was a drone strike, I will not say that it was.
And those lines are literal lines. We'll talk about that in a second. Go ahead.
Yeah, they are blacked out, certainly. But you're right. You know, that was something that I thought about. Regardless of what some may think about it, for me, you know, being a human operator, meaning human intelligence, that's the acronym, human. Yeah, I had a lot of questions about it. And I wondered, why not collect on this guy? Why not try to penetrate his network? Why not, you know, try to get somebody inserted who can get all of the secrets to know what the next attack's going to be? Because the moment this person died is the moment we lost that opportunity. So I do want to challenge the narrative in that, what are we supposed to be doing? Are we supposed to be so paramilitaristic and in eliminating HVTs, high-value targets, or should we be trying to penetrate their network to learn what they're going to do next? I think the latter, but again, that's just my opinion.
So sections of your book are censored by the CIA. The agency reviews all books by former CIA employees and redacts or censors information it considers sensitive. But you've left the black bars in the book. I'm going to guess that some of those sections, you're talking about the role of the Pakistani intelligence service, which is presumably helping to make the bombs the Taliban uses. That's what we've heard. Why can't their story be told?
It's an excellent question, and it's the exact reason why I left in the black bars. It's to show, hey, this is what I was able to talk about. This is what the USG is comfortable with revealing. This is what they're letting you know. And this is what they told me I couldn't talk about. And obviously, you can tell I'm not trying to be dodgy with you or cagey. I just got to be very careful because I have been censored. And, you know, what you saw that was blacked out, and you say it's Pakistan. I don't say it's Pakistan. You notice I never say that once in the book. Mm. That's what they felt comfortable with, and that's it is what it is.
Since the Congressional Torture Report came out, there's been a lot of soul searching about what the purpose of the CIA is. What do you think it is?
Well, the role of the CIA is what it always has been since its inception, and that's to collect human intelligence. And they still do that, and they still do it better than anybody else in the world, rest assured. And yeah, you're right. There's been a lot of mistakes that have happened over the past 15 years, and you want to talk about human torture? Well, we stopped that. It stopped before I ever even joined. It was a mistake, and it was a mess, and I'm not proud of it. And I'm really glad that it stopped.
You call your book Trial by Fire, kind of your trial by fire into the CIA, but it's also an introduction to the agency and national security and its slippages. Are you the exception to the rule of CIA field operatives, or is your story pretty typical, do you think?
Probably. There's a lot of folks like me who have gone through some of the same stuff, some of the same hardships, because let me tell you, it ain't easy. If you ever can get used to having six different names and answering your phone in five different languages and, you know, lying to everybody who loves you most, then, brother, you're a stronger man than me.
Let me ask you about that stress and how you dealt with it, because you describe your battles with substance abuse, alcohol, OxyContin. Were you able to hide that from your bosses at the agency?
Yeah, I was to a degree. I mean, I don't know. The guy that I admired the most, I call him Boss Man in the book. He was my boss. He knew immediately. He knew I wasn't right. He knew I wasn't sound of mind because he had seen me at my best and he was seeing me at my worst. And he knew on the second that I was struggling and I had an addiction problem. And you know what? He's also the one that saved me and told me, you got to stop this. What are you doing? Like, get your stuff together. And I'm very thankful to him.
Doug, final question. If your story is business as usual at the CIA, not just, you know, substance abuse, but the Pashto lessons and the whole thing, what kind of liability is this for U.S. foreign policy? What have we failed to achieve because of this is the way the agency is?
Look, if you read my book and you look at the agency as a failure, then I have failed. I hope that people read it and go, man, they could be incredible, but ... because of the reasons that I lay out. It should be viewed as we are trying. And if you see it as a failure, then okay, please offer us a solution and we're going to keep moving forward with that too. Don't ever forget that CIA is not staffed by robots yet. It's still red-blooded humans, you know, doing everything they can.
Douglas Laux's new memoir, written with Ralph Pizzullo, is called Left of Boom, How a Young CIA Case Officer Penetrated the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Doug, thanks very much.
Hey, I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Here in Boston, we're getting ready for a long weekend. Monday is Patriots Day, a holiday here in Massachusetts, recalling the start of the American Revolution. It's also the day when runners take on the 26-plus miles of the Boston Marathon. 3 years ago, of course, twin bombs went off near the finish line. It'll be some time before that trauma will be erased. But this next story is focused on something else, or rather, someone else. On Monday, the men's winner in 2013 and 2015, Lalisa Desisa, will be back to defend his title, and his fellow Ethiopians will be watching with great interest. That includes two Ethiopian Americans on the high school track team in Cambridge, just across the river from our studios. Here's the world's Jeb Sharp.
Yeah, I thought that was over.
Yeah. Scott, can I put my jacket in your car?
Sure. Every Saturday morning, the high school distance runners meet here at Fresh Pond in Cambridge. They banter with their coach, Scott Cody, for a few minutes, and then lope off into the suburbs for a long run.
It's a nice bonding thing. The idea is hopefully they don't go out on too much on Friday night. They get home early, get a good night's rest, do a nice long run, and it's a commitment thing.
Two of the most committed runners on the team are Isu Alamsegud and Daniel Ashile. They met in middle school, both recent immigrants from Ethiopia, learning English, trying to fit in. Danny loves the sense of belonging running gives him.
I like just like running with a group, just talking about like our life, joking around, laughing. And I feel like running is like a part of me. Like I run every day, like no days off. The coach, everything just like makes me happy.
His friend Isu was going to play soccer at the high school, Cambridge Ringe and Latin, but Danny persuaded him to try cross-country instead. Isu almost quit after his first practice. It was so grueling. But he's grown to love it too, the competition and the social life.
Being with a team is like really, really helpful because they help you with like everything. Like if I needed help with like homework or anything, I would just talk to them and they would help me.
The two runners are seniors now, but their coach, Scott Cody, remembers when they turned up as freshmen 4 years ago.
And I'm like, oh, here are these two freshmen. They didn't really say anything. 2 weeks later, one of the seniors was complaining, do you need to talk to these guys? They're running too fast. They're pushing in all the runs. And I was like, sorry, these guys are they're really talented.
He says it makes sense that their Ethiopian heritage is a big motivating factor.
The top athletes in Ethiopia, they're runners, so they actually looked up to runners, whereas, you know, most American kids don't really care what runners do. So I think that was a big part of it, that, wow, this is something I'm culturally that we're known for and I want to be really good at.
Cody likes to tell the story of how Isu visited Ethiopia a couple of years ago and came back with Ethiopian shirts for the whole team. The Cambridge runners were quite the sight, apparently, showing up at meets in Ethiopian colors. They'll be out in force again on Monday to watch the marathon. Danny and Isu will be cheering for fellow Ethiopian Lalisa Desisa as he tries for a record third win after his triumphs in 2013 and 2015.
The one thing I want to see is like Ethiopians win, but I also want to see like a good race from like everyone.
Isu has a sobering memory of the 2013 race when the bombs hit. His mother was at the finish line but left before the explosions. Isu was out watching the race with teammates. They had run part of the course, and his mom was frantic trying to find him.
She thought I was still there, so she was, like, calling me and crying. And I didn't have my phone on me. So, like, when I came back from running, I had, like, a lot of missed calls.
Isu says what happened in 2013 isn't something you ever forget. But he takes heart from the love that has been showered on Boston ever since. For Danny, the marathon has become a personal goal.
I want to run the marathon. This is where I grew up, and I know the places. I want to be like the Biba Desisa, and I want to win the marathon one day.
For these young immigrants, the marathon has become a potent symbol of their intersecting passions for running, for Ethiopia, and for their American hometown. For The World, Jeb Sharp, Boston.
I'm doing 8.
Hey!
What? How is
this
the longest
covered?
Speaking of Ethiopians in Boston, I think I hear them coming down the road now. This is Boston's own Debo Band, led by Ethiopian American Danny McConnon, bounding their way through a mix of sounds from the Horn of Africa and high-energy big band rock and jazz, like this track from Debo Band's just-released CD, Ere Gobez. The airport sniffer dogs in England that miss the drugs but find the cheese. That's just around the corner here on The World. Presidential campaigns are great for late-night comedians. The more the candidates talk about their plans, or lack of plans in some cases, the easier it gets to lampoon them. Take Kate McKinnon on Saturday Night Live. She does a great impersonation of Hillary Clinton, an often awkward candidate as she presents her. But that's just one side of the candidate. This reporter says there are at least two Hillary Clintons.
there's something that seemed to happen to her when she would get out of U.S. airspace, and then suddenly she would relax and be herself.
Indira Lakshmanan covered Clinton's 2008 run for the presidency and her time as Secretary of State. Lakshmanan has an article in Politico about that titled "The Mystery of the Two Hillaries."
From the moment that she came to the back of the plane on her first trip as Secretary of State, it was as if a completely different person was inhabiting her body.
Yeah, tell us what you saw on that plane when you were following her around as Secretary of State that we're not seeing now.
Well, she was a totally different person. She was that warm, caring, charismatic person that her friends and people who've worked with her over the decades say they see, but which it's hard for the public to perceive when she's on the stump, when she's making these speeches in the big arenas. And what I saw over years of covering her was that what she was definitely able to do was connect with people overseas, whether it was ordinary people who would cram thousands of them into, for example, a Jakarta slum in her first overseas trip as Secretary of State, just because they all wanted to get a glimpse of her going into a maternal health clinic, or whether it was foreign leaders who she was dealing with, who said that she seemed so much more down to earth when they met her in person and with whom she exhibited these people-to-people skills.
Now, you went with Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State to a lot of places overseas. There was one moment where she was in South Korea and speaking to some university students. We kind of saw a reveal of the other Hillary, the non-policy wonk Hillary there, right?
She was at Ewha Women's University in Seoul. It was on her first trip overseas as secretary, and she was getting peppered with all these questions about balancing work and career and, you know, what it's like to be a female secretary of state. And this one woman got up and said, "I have a question related to love." And she paused, and then she said, "How did you know that your husband was?" And at first, we couldn't hear the end of the question, and we were all sort of like nervous and wondering what was she trying to say. But what she had really said was, "How did you know your husband was the right one for you?" And Hillary Clinton sort of let out this incredible laugh on stage as if she was hanging out with her girlfriends and said, "Oh my goodness, I feel more like an advice columnist than like Secretary of State." And she launched into this very sort of touching impromptu meditation on love. And she talked about her husband, Bill Clinton, as her best friend and their marriage as this endless conversation. And then she told this touching story about a close friend of hers who had died, who told her at the end of her life, "I've loved and been loved, and all the rest is background music." And then it was just sort of like you could have heard a pin drop, and then the students were cheering. It was incredible how overseas, this was just one example among many of how she had foreign audiences really in her thrall. The difference is they just weren't American audiences.
Yeah, I mean, it does make it odd why she has seemingly ceded so much of the kind of charisma real estate to Bernie Sanders.
I think it's a really good question, and I think it speaks to, again, the difficult experience she's had in this country, in the press. And there's something that seemed to happen to her when she would get out of U.S. airspace, and then suddenly she would relax and be herself. She was, you know, very easy on the stage with foreign journalists when they interviewed her and with foreign audiences, no matter how hard the questions were. Even in Pakistan, I'm thinking, when she was really pounded about U.S. drone strikes and civilian casualties, and yet she managed to keep her composure, defend U.S. policy, and by the end, I think, win some people over.
Reporter Indira Lakshmanan speaking with us from Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
This next story kind of reminds me of the children's book, The Story of Ferdinand. In case you don't remember, Ferdinand is a bull in Spain who is sent off to the bullfighting ring, but he doesn't want to charge the toreador. He just wants to smell flowers. Like these dogs making headlines today at Manchester Airport in England, airport officials spent over $1.5 million to train them to sniff out cocaine and heroin, but the dogs are only interested in sausage and cheese. My BBC colleague Danny Shaw has been looking into this and joins me from London. Danny, tell me more about what these dogs did wrong.
Marco, this is an extraordinary story. Manchester Airport is the UK's third largest airport. 22 million passengers going in and out every year. It's got three passenger terminals, one freight terminal. So it's a massive airport. And it's obviously a hub for smuggling, for Class A drugs, illegal drugs. and other illegal activities taking place, which is why the airport has invested a lot of money, as you say, well over $1 million in a new dog unit, new kennels, and 6 sniffer dogs to try and detect illegal drugs and other items. And what we've been hearing is that inspectors went in to see how they were doing, and in a 7-month period, these dogs detected no Class A drugs. That means no heroin, no cocaine at all coming in through the airport. But what one of the dogs that was trained to detect animal products picked up was cheese and sausages. It wasn't looking for bushmeat as it should have been doing. It was only interested in cheese and sausages. That is true. That is straight out of the inspection report.
Well, I know from personal experience, dog obedience training, if the dog fails, it's not really the dog that failed. It's the trainer that failed. So did the dogs not get trained properly, and will they get retrained?
Well, I think there are issues about the training. I think it's also perhaps about where the dogs are looking, because, you know, with so many flights coming in and just a, you know, handful of dogs, basically, they can't be sniffing out every single bag, every single item of luggage that's brought in, every single passenger. You have to target those flights where you think there's a risk, and that relies on intelligence. Good intelligence is the key. So perhaps the intelligence is failing, or perhaps somehow it's the organization of what those dogs are doing that's not working, and they need to be identifying the right flights, the high-risk flights, in order to detect things that are more dangerous than cheese, frankfurters, chorizo, or other sausages.
I mean, for a lot of people, I think the big surprise in the story is how much money was spent on these dogs. What are officials saying about that?
Well, I think a case was made to improve the kennels at Manchester Airport. I don't know what the state of the previous facilities for dogs were, but over £1 million is a lot of money. It is a big airport. But clearly, I think the inspectors are concerned that they are not getting the value from that investment that they should be getting. They were expecting to find a lot more detections by the dogs than they are at the moment. So it'll be, I think, quite a while before an investment of that type is made in another dogs unit at another airport in Britain.
Danny, please tell me that airport officials are thinking for these dogs professional development and not sacking them.
Yeah, I feel a bit sorry for those poor dogs. It's probably just as well, perhaps, that they don't listen to the radio, or they don't read the newspapers, or read this inspection report. Who knows? Perhaps they do. But I'm sure they'll just be happy with their normal rewards and treats.
Danny Shaw with our colleagues at the BBC. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. In Florida, rising sea levels are driving a wedge between Republican mayors and their national party on climate change.
It's making it harder to be a Republican when you have nobody in the party that wants to recognize it. That's why we're hoping that we can get the candidates to tell us, if you don't believe it, well, why?
That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Tomorrow, Pope Francis is planning to get up close and personal with Europe's migrant crisis. The pontiff is going to the Greek island of Lesbos. Hundreds of thousands of refugees have arrived on Lesbos over the past year, most of them risking their lives in a dangerous boat crossing from Turkey. Pope Francis has urged Europeans to offer the refugees sanctuary. Instead, the European Union has taken steps recently to restrict the entry of new migrants. Father Christoforos Schoff is a Greek Orthodox priest on Lesbos. He's helped set up camps and coordinate assistance as migrants have poured onto the island. I asked him what he's hoping the Pope will see during his visit.
Well, I'd like him to see the reality from the viewpoint of the refugees themselves. I've actually seen this a number of times when dignitaries have come to the island. They've cleaned up everything. They've even stopped refugees from coming or arriving to the registration centers just to make the picture look better. The truth is the reality is a lot different, especially following the agreement between Turkey and the EU. Everybody who arrives is arrested and put into a detention center. that detention center is not very nice. And I'm really hoping they're not going to take him to another camp, which is a little bit cleaner, looks a little bit better. I think he really needs to see Moria refugee camp, which actually right now is functioning as a detention center.
Yeah, describe Moria for us, because I think there's a perception that these are refugee camps. People can go in and walk out. Moria is very different, and there are a lot of Afghan refugees there, correct?
Yeah, well, actually, Syrians and Afghans and people from other countries as well are there now. Since the 20th of April, they've been being locked in there. It's surrounded by riot police. Moria actually used to be a military prison. It's surrounded by high fences with barbed wire. Really, the situation now is that we're talking about families, small children that are living there under the dire conditions. A lot of people I've talked to have been there, visited. I was actually at a protest there against the detention of these people. And a lot of people talked about they didn't have milk for the children. They didn't have blankets. Many people were actually sleeping outside. That's the situation that we're looking at. And in many ways, the situation since the agreement has gotten worse for the refugees themselves.
Pope Francis has this way of shining a light on the world's poor and downtrodden. And visits like this are symbolic. Actual change, a little harder to discern. What do you hope will be the impact of Pope Francis's trip, especially if he goes to a detention camp like Moria?
Well, I hope it'll shed light on the actual situation. It's easier to use symbolism sometimes and actually getting people to do this, but it's also important to take a stand, I think, especially in his position, to take a stand for humanity, to take a stand for loving your neighbor, hospitality. And I really do hope that it will shed light on this from a religious standpoint, but also for people of different faiths and life views.
I mean, a stand for humanity, that seems pretty obvious, but what about policy? Because it's becoming harder for these refugees to get into Europe, and these paths to Europe are closing off. Will the Pope's visit change that?
Realistically speaking, I don't think it really will, but I do believe that there should be a grassroots movement to change policy, especially, for example, in the case of Norway. The coalition government has said that their political platform is built, quote, on Christian humanistic cultural inheritance, and yet they're closing more and more doors, making it more and more difficult, not giving permanent asylum to unaccompanied minors, not allowing them to reunite with their families. And I believe it's time for the people, also people of different religions, to stand up and say we need to treat these people better and see them in many ways as ourselves, because this could have been us. This could have been you, or it could have been me. And I really think this needs to lead to actually a grassroots of movement for human rights and for respect of people in spite of their differences in politics, ethnicity, sexuality, or whatever the case may be. These are brothers and sisters.
Christoforos Schuf is a Greek Orthodox priest based on the island of Lesbos. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Here's some recent news that grabbed our attention. It's about Antarctica. Scientists have long warned that one part of the continent, the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, could potentially dump a massive amount of ice into the sea as global temperatures rise. But their warnings were generally about a future hundreds of years away. Now a new study suggests that future could be much closer. It found that melting of the West Antarctic Ice Sheet could add more than 3 feet to global sea level rise by just the end of the century. Now I know it can be hard to wrap your head around an idea like that, which is why we turn to a 30-year veteran of Antarctic research to help us imagine what the ice sheet is like and why it's such a threat. Robert Binschadler is a former NASA glaciologist, and he spoke with the World's Environment reporter Carolyn Beeler.
The first thing to know about the West Antarctic Ice Sheet is that it's huge, a slab of ice the size of Europe.
When you first get off an airplane that has taken you out to the ice sheet, you've flown for hours.
Bob Binschadler says it's a long flight, even from the main U.S. base in Antarctica. All you see out the window the whole time is ice.
And you get out, and the first thing that always strikes me is that first breath of really cold air. The next thing I notice is just walking on the surface, it crunches. You get that audible sense that, I'm on the ice sheet.
Then Binschadler says, you notice the wind.
Because if there's a wind, it will chill you. And you'll notice which way the wind is coming from, and you'll probably turn your back to it and pull up your parka hood. and then you know you're kind of there on the ice sheet. In most areas of the ice sheet, you look around and you just see white, just a flat white expanse going off in all directions.
Most of the West Antarctic ice sheet is that flat white expanse. But around the edges, the ice suddenly meets the warmer ocean in a vertical cliff, and things get more interesting. Tiny cracks form in the ice as the shelf slides downward toward the sea. Those cracks widen into crevasses hundreds of feet deep, and every once in a while, huge chunks of ice slide off into the sea. Now, this kind of thing happens all around the poles, but the chunks are bigger in the West Antarctic. Think the size of Rhode Island. And the ice sheet is more of a problem when it comes to sea level rise because it's also incredibly unstable.
We knew 35, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, that it was sitting on a bed that's primarily below sea level. Turns out that means it was sitting on a bed that is layered in marine sediments, not hard bedrock.
So unlike most ice sheets, water can melt this one from below.
Part of it is that melts the underside of these ice shelves, these last seaward extensions of the glaciers. It also involves water just filling up cracks within the ice, and bigger chunks of the ice shelf will calve off.
These calving events are dramatic when they happen. But usually, Ben Shadler says, the ice sheet is peaceful. White, flat, and boring. So boring, it disguises the threat.
You can't really feel this instability at all. Antarctica is so big that when we talk about this 1 meter rise in sea level as very likely by the end of this century, a 3 foot rise, that actually is just a 1% reduction in the size of the ice sheet.
Ben Shadler's retired now, and he spends a lot of his time doing outreach, explaining the link between melting ice and rising seas. And he says it's hard to explain to people why the ice sheet is such a threat when it looks so tranquil.
We can show them glaciers that have retreated markedly, and they get that. But we don't have real pictures to show them of these changes happening in the ice sheet that are actually at a much larger scale. That's part of the problem. You can't take a picture of some of these really large things.
But for Ben Shadler, when he was on the ice, its destructive potential was never far from his mind.
You are there in the midst of big nature. You get a better sense of your size. It's very much a sense of standing there and thinking about, this is the piece of ice that really matters. And it will, where I'm standing right now, impact the lives of people worldwide.
Robert Ben Shadler is a retired NASA scientist and an expert on the West Antarctic ice sheet. Our report was produced by the world's Carolyn Beeler, with sound recorded by audio artist Douglas Quinn. Okay, time to bring that story and all that water perhaps home. One of the places in the world that's most vulnerable to rising sea levels is right here in the U.S., South Florida. And it's already happening. Coastal flooding is already a growing concern there. And that's made climate change a growing political concern for many local politicians, including many Republicans, which puts them increasingly at odds with the rest of their party. The world's Jason Margolis went to South Florida to hear more about that.
All of this is Coral Gables inside these lines.
Jim Kaysen is the mayor of Coral Gables, a city of 50,000 on Florida's Atlantic coast, right next to Miami. For him, climate change is very real.
All of these brown areas are, as you'll see from the map, 1 foot, 0, 2 feet.
Kaysen is showing me a newly drawn elevation map of his city. Big swaths of it are already at or barely above sea level. About $3 billion in high-end real estate runs along the shore here. Kaysen has little power to protect it from rising waters.
Other places can build walls, berms, sand dunes, and so on. We're on coral, which means the water will be coming up from the bottom.
During very high tides these days, streets in South Florida regularly flood. Sea levels have risen almost an inch a year here over the past few years. And conservative projections estimate they'll rise 3 feet more this century. I asked Kaysen, so what's the solution?
You have to hope we slow down the melting of the ice, because our future is the future of ice.
But halting melting polar ice will take leadership far beyond Coral Gables. And Kaysen, a Republican, doesn't see that coming from his fellow party members in higher office. Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott's office allegedly told employees they couldn't even use the terms climate change or global warming. Scott has denied this, but his office also denied my interview request to speak with him or anybody in his administration about climate change. At the federal level, Florida Senator and former presidential candidate Marco Rubio is in line with many leading Republicans in dismissing or minimizing the threat of climate change. So are the party's two leading remaining candidates for president, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. Add it all up, it's creating a bit of an identity crisis for Mayor Kaysen.
It's making it harder to be a Republican when you have nobody in the party that wants to recognize it. That's why we're hoping that we can get the candidates to tell us, if you don't believe it, well, why?
Kaysen is one of 21 Florida mayors, Republicans and Democrats, who sent a letter to all the presidential candidates imploring them to pay attention to climate science.
If you're a mayor, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. If the water's coming and you need to protect your citizens, you're going to do that. So you're not going to debate whether it's happening or not. It's a reality.
Christina DeConcini is with the nonpartisan World Resources Institute. I went for a stroll with DeConcini just up the coast in Hollywood, Florida. During high tides, water here bubbles up from the storm drains and the soil. We stop in front of a home along the edge of a lake where a resident has built a crude wall of dirt and stone.
The people that built this wall here are trying to protect their own property.
It won't be enough to keep the waters at bay. The county knows this. It's considering drastic adaptation solutions like converting a local golf course into a giant bathtub that could hold water during floods. But it would be just a small short-term fix. This area will need much more help. And DeConcini is frustrated by the local, state, federal divide.
People in Washington or in Tallahassee just seem like they're living on a different planet.
DeConcini isn't singling out only Republicans, and she said some in the GOP are starting to come around.
Congressman Curbelo from this area has just started a climate caucus that's bipartisan in the House. We saw 11 Republican members of Congress sign a resolution.
That resolution recognizes human-caused climate change and calls for steps to fight it. But the statement offers no specifics, and fewer than 5% of House Republicans signed on. And even they don't seem to want to talk about it. When I reached out to the authors of the resolution for an interview, I was rebuffed. John Gable, a former Republican operative in Washington, wasn't surprised. He says talking too much about climate change can alienate core Republicans.
So you don't necessarily want to go on radio because, you know, you might say something that's a little bit too moderate and you'll get in trouble. So the question is, what do we do about that?
Gable is trying to do something about it through a new group called All Sides that's seeking to overcome bipartisanship on a number of issues. He believes a middle ground can be found, that action on climate change can become less toxic for Republicans. Coral Gables Mayor Kaysen isn't so optimistic. I asked what it would take for Florida's Republican leaders to take climate change seriously.
I don't think they will. I don't know why.
Other local South Florida leaders also say the time for a middle ground has passed. Nearby, Miami Beach has already spent more than $100 million on defenses against rising waters. And that's almost certainly just the beginning. For The World, Jason Margolis, Miami.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. China wants to crash the global soccer party. That's pretty much the gist of an announcement this week from Beijing. Chinese officials said they're planning to invest in soccer big time with two main goals. First, to propel China into the elite of world soccer, and second, to win a World Cup by mid-century. That'd be soccer's most prestigious jewel. They have a lot of work to do, though. The Chinese women's team is pretty decent, made the quarterfinals at last year's World Cup. But the men's squad is currently ranked 81st in the world, not far behind smaller nations like Cyprus and Burkina Faso. Andre Markovitz is a professor at the University of Michigan who's written about the intersection of sports and politics. Andre, this is kind of like the Yankees, best team money can buy. Can China do this, just invest so much money that they can crash into the elite of world soccer?
First of all, I have to take umbrage with mischaracterizing my beloved Yankees. I know this is blasphemous to, in Red Sox country. Anyway, the Chinese are doing this, but it takes a long time to establish this. You can wean brilliant individual kids, put them in some school in Florida, and they become great tennis players or phenomenal gymnasts. You can't do this with soccer or basketball or all these other team sports. Money makes a big difference, but it will take a long time for them to become as great as, I don't know, Brazil is or Germany are or whatever.
Well, old China says it's going to have 30 million elementary and middle school kids playing soccer. Why won't that work?
18 million American kids play soccer in some level. Playing and following are two different things. It's the following that really creates the culture that, in fact, propels a team sport into the upper echelons. Millions of Chinese kids following Lionel Messi on their iPhone. Not only do you need Kobe and LeBron, who are gods in China, but also a Chinese god, which is, of course, Yao Ming. And so once the Chinese actually create a great soccer player, that's when China will arrive.
Do they have one great soccer player right now?
No, and none that I know on the horizon.
So you've got the perspective of the former Soviet bloc of once living in Romania. China is a communist country, lest anyone forget. Is that an advantage or a disadvantage for them in terms of getting organized, building talent, and creating this following that you're talking about?
I actually think in this case it almost doesn't matter. Yes, of course, the only legitimate authority is that of the Communist Party. But of course, it's really far from the old Maoist and Stalinist system. It's really a mixture. It's a dictatorship politically, but in fact, a market. If anything, it's sort of a capitalism gone wild. And they basically want to create a soccer culture, which in fact will happen, but not by virtue of old planning. It's not because of Stalinism. It'll happen precisely because via iPhones, Chinese kids already know Barcelona the way Barcelona kids do.
Andrei Markovits, bottom line, your predictions. When do the Chinese women win the World Cup? When do the men win it?
Oh, God. The women will win it in probably by 2030. The men will not win it before 2050, if then.
Andrei Markovits, a professor at the University of Michigan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, big news for Japanese music fans. New music there from the new Hikaru Utada, her post-retirement career, I guess. Reporter Naomi Gingold, you're not just a journalist, Naomi, but you were once a Japanese culture consultant, English-speaking liaison to any number of cool arts projects happening in Japan. What was the song we were just hearing?
This is the new song, or one of the new songs from Utada Hikaru, known in English as Hikaru Utada, Japan's biggest pop star, really, who announced 5 years ago at the age of 28 that she was kind of retiring, and then earlier this year announced that she was coming out of retirement.
And what's the story? Why is she coming back?
You know, people called it her retirement at the time. I think she officially spoke of it as a hiatus, where she kind of wanted to grow as a real person, get to do normal human activities is kind of the phrasing she used. I guess she did that and decided now this was the time for her to come back.
So who is Hikaru Utada? I know she's kind of iconic in modern Japanese pop music, but why is she important to Japan?
She burst out on the scene in the late 90s in Japan when she was 16, and she kind of revolutionized what it meant to be a Japanese pop star. At the time, her sound was very R&B, and it was the first time you had any Japanese pop stars bringing an R&B sound into the mainstream.
What was Japanese pop music before Utada?
You had all these, like, really manufactured idols. That was the mainstream pop star. And there was a lot of dance music. I mean, you had singer-songwriters, but nobody kind of did what she did and put it all together. Mm. And I mean, after her, you know, you've had pop stars come up, or you had pop stars who sang very R&B music, but you'd never had anyone reach kind of the pinnacle of Utada. If you look at the top 10 best-selling albums in Japanese history, three of those are hers.
Wow, that's incredible. And we should remember that Japanese pop culture, when she was queen, really reigned all over Asia. as opposed to the global popularity of somebody like Psy from Korea with his billion-plus viewed Gangnam Style. So is Utada re-entering a more mature Japanese pop scene, and will other Asian countries still like her, or have they moved on?
Oh, globally speaking, I think in some sense her influence is down, though she also now has somewhat of an audience in the U.S. She also kind of became well-known for having the theme song to a couple big video games. She's pretty universally loved across Japan. You know, even people who don't normally listen to pop music, you know, everyone pretty much loves her. So I think she's still going to sell a lot. I think people are still going to love her music.
So Naomi, for our listeners, many of whom probably don't know Utada Hikaru's music, introduce us to a classic track of hers.
Gosh, so maybe I would do Letters. It's about someone sending letters to a former lover and hoping she'll hear a response. And at the end, she's like, I don't need you anymore.
I was speaking there with reporter Naomi Gingold about Hikaru Utada, and we'll let Hikaru Utada have the last word with her song, Letters. If you like what you're hearing, we've got more of Hikaru's music online, including her video for Goodbye Happiness. Don't worry, it's not a sad song. Plenty of dancing, hand puppets, and dramatic lighting. Just head over to PRI.org. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.